We're back in business. The next case is United States against Nurek. Mr. Cook.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Cook. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Joseph Nurek, in this appeal. There are four issues in this appeal, all of which involve Mr. Nurek's sentence. First, concerns an obstruction of justice enhancement. The second, the government's refusal to move for the additional 1 point for acceptance of responsibility. Third issue is that ex post facto clause claim with respect to the what guideline manual to use. Fourth is a reasonableness argument. Because of time constraints, I probably won't get to the last two arguments, but if this court has any questions as to either of those arguments, I'd be happy to answer them at any time. Otherwise, I'm going to begin with issue number two, which concerns the government's refusal to move for the additional 1 point for acceptance of responsibility.
Could I just start you off, Mr. Cook? Maybe you could answer this for me. Whether or not you agree that even if Dr. Nurek had received the additional one-level reduction, his guideline range still would have exceeded the statutory maximum. I mean, of course, assuming that none of his other challenges were successful. If so, how can we say that the refusal to give the added reduction impacted the sentence?
Well, I think you're right that if that's the only issue, there really is no issue. But it isn't. So I think if we were to take the two levels off for obstruction and another one for acceptance, then we get somewhere. So I think that's why the issue's been raised. But you are right that 1 point would do nothing, essentially. But we still raise it. We think we're right. The government's reasons for denying the point were not that Mr. Nurek did not timely notify the government. The plain language of the provision provides that the government move for the 1 point if an individual timely notifies. Here, the government's reasons are that Mr. Nurek didn't accept responsibility. If we look at the structure of 3E1.1.
Well, the government also maintains that along with failing to accept responsibility, he obstructed evidence.
That's true. I think there's probably three aspects of the acceptance argument, that lack of remorse and wanting to sentence him at the statutory max. But I think all of those things still go to whether he accepted responsibility. And under the structure of the guideline, that's determined under subsection A by the district court.
But what support do you have for that proposition that, you know, that the government is required to move for a 3E.1 reduction, you know, if the defendant's plea was timely, even when the government, you know, plausibly believes that someone failed to accept responsibility, obstructed evidence, and the other things that you yourself just noted?
Well, the plain language of the provision. I don't think we need to look any farther than that. It's bifurcated. The subdivision A provides for acceptance of responsibility as determined by the district court. Subdivision B does not say whether the government can move for the motion if it believes Mr. Nurek accepted responsibility. It says the government would move for the 1 point reduction.
Well, the government's argument, of course, was that he didn't deserve any, that he wasn't entitled to any reduction for acceptance of responsibility, let alone that third point that's at issue here. So I'm having a little problem, you know.
Well, but I guess our point is the district court determines that based on the plain language of the provision. The district court determines whether he accepts responsibility.
It's but nothing. The government is entitled to disagree and decline to move for the extra point. That's how the guideline reads.
I don't think so. If you read the guideline, subdivision A says acceptance of responsibility. Subdivision B says the government can move if the defendant timely notified of his intent to plead guilty. It doesn't say the government can move if the government agrees with the district court that he accepted responsibility. It's not what it says. Of course, that's what it could say. The guideline could very well read that, but it doesn't.
It makes the application of the extra point contingent upon the government's motion, which it, in its discretion, may withhold.
Right.
Even if the basis for that is a disagreement with the district court on some other guideline.
Well, our position is simply that the government's discretion is whether he timely notified. That's the only discretion.
The guideline, you're reading the guideline as if it said the government must move if the plea is timely for the extra level. But it doesn't say that. It says the government may move.
Well,
why do we turn a permissive clause into a mandatory clause?
Well, it's not that it's mandatory. It's that the reason has to be timely notification. So if the government had said
it was true only if the government must move if it's timely.
Well,
right. The guideline says the government may move if it's timely, but it doesn't say must. And what that means, and what I would ordinarily think that means, is even if it's timely, the government may have other reasons for not bestowing this extra benefit.
Well, we would respectfully disagree on the. I mean, if that were the case, the guideline would just have to read the government may move for an additional 1 point reduction. Period. That's
no,
not what
only
it reads.
If it's timely. The government is not authorized to move if the plea is untimely, mid-trial. Then it's not authorized at all.
So the reason for moving has to be the timely plea, which in this case, on the record, that clearly was not the reason.
And I just don't understand that. If there's a state statute which says a person who is 18 may apply for a driver's license, it's perfectly permissible not to apply for a driver's license for a reason other than the fact that you're under 18. You may choose not to apply for a driver's license because you don't want to drive.
True. But there's no language about timely notification there. In the plain language of the provision is timely notification. That wasn't the reason here. That's the argument. Understand the may versus must. But our position is if the government's going to move or not move, it's based on timely notification, and that's it. It can't be based on another reason, and we rely on the plain language of the provision. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, so unless this court has any other questions. Thanks.
Certainly, Mr. Cook.
Thank you.
Ms. Ruder.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Julie Ruder, and I represent the United States in this appeal. In order to respond to some of the issues raised concerning this Section 3E1.1 and the government's motion for this third point off, some of Your Honors' questions and some of defense counsel's argument focused on the plain language of that provision. The plain language states that if the defendant qualifies for a decrease under subsection A, then it goes on to describe the offense level being 16 or greater, and upon motion of the government stating that the defendant has assisted authorities in the investigation or prosecution of his own misconduct by timely notifying authorities of his intention to enter a plea of guilty, then it goes on to describe how that would save resources. In that case, a one-level deduction should be warranted. Several things there. First of all, the plain language of the guideline does not say if the court finds the defendant qualifies for a decrease under subsection A. It says instead if the defendant qualifies. The government reads that language to be clear that the government has the ability to disagree with the district court, as has happened in several other cases, not in this circuit, but in other circuits where this has come up, and decide on that basis not to make the motion under Section 3E1.1B. Likewise, just to clarify, It makes clear that it is only upon motion of the government stating that the defendant has assisted authorities. The government has discretion to make that motion or not to make it, so long as there are no unconstitutional or otherwise impermissible motives. So based on the plain language, Your Honors, the government is able to exercise its discretion not to make the motion based on its assessment that the defendant has not accepted responsibility, and that clearly was the case here. As we pointed out in our papers, there was extensive discussion both in the written submissions and during the sentencing itself, where the government expressed all the reasons why not only had the defendant obstructed justice, but also had not shown an extraordinary acceptance of responsibility here. And when this issue came up before the district court not only was not surprised that the government did not make the motion, but anticipated that we would not.
Could we go on to something else?
Certainly.
Is it proper under 3553 for a judge to consider the benefits to other prisoners of a defendant's incarceration, such, you know, as the educational benefit to other prisoners of having Dr. Nurek incarcerated with them? I mean, isn't it clear that the court discussed this in the context of considering the 3553 factor relating to a defendant's educational and vocational needs? I know that you've argued in your papers that, you know, it was an aside and whatnot, but...
To answer your first question, Your Honor, if the sole question is would it be appropriate for a court to increase a sentence because of perceived benefits to prisoners, it's not the government's understanding that that's what Section 3553A is talking about. So the answer on
otherwise
that would be...
Otherwise, we just fill our jails with PhDs.
Indeed. And so the answer to that is no.
And the judge could have ordered the U.S. attorney to report to jail, too, in order to help out the other prisoners.
Yes, Your Honor. So the answer to the first part of your question is no. On the second part
Ooh.
Of... yes. On the second part of your question, though, about the particular context in which this was raised... It was very clear from the context that the district court was not advancing the defendant's education as a reason for the 20-year sentence. The district court gave many reasons for the 20-year sentence that dealt primarily with the need to incapacitate the defendant, the need to protect the public, the likely risk of recidivism, the need for specific deterrence, and the very horrendous nature of the offense. The statement about the defendant's education, I think, can best be described as his attempt to, as we said in the papers, put a silver lining on, you know, something that perhaps the defendant could do to help others. And the district court had made comments about the defendant's education, had noted his PhD, had noted the fact that he was very learned and very educated, and even in terms of the conditions that he was setting, made an exception as part of the supervision that the defendant could help perhaps in forming curriculums as opposed to actually teaching students, giving a nod to his background and experience.
You mean when he's 78 years old?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, this transcript is characterized by an awful lot of tangential discussion. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, this is about as clear as a case for a maximum sentence for an unrepentant child molester as I can envision.
I agree.
So there was just a great deal of hand-wringing on the part of the district court here that was completely unnecessary and set up all kinds of issues for appeal that ought not to have been there because it was all tangential to the issue at hand, which was whether the maximum sentence here, which is 5 years below the bottom of the guidelines range, was appropriate.
I certainly agree, Your Honor, that the 20-year sentence was appropriate, and I made it absolutely clear throughout that we thought the longest sentence possible under the law was appropriate for this defendant.
Okay, I'm done venting.
Do your honors have any other questions?
You know, I was sort of interested in something. Dr. Nurek argued that his communication with victim B had no obstructing impact on the child pornography charge. How would the communication with victim B have impacted the ability of the government to prosecute him on the pornography charge, given that the pornography images, the pornographic images, were found on his computer, and he admitted that he had child pornography on his computer? In other words, did anyone else have access to that computer so that it necessitated testimony by victim B that linked Nurek to the pornography?
Yes, Your Honor. There were at least two people beyond the defendant that had access to the computer. One of them was victim B, and one of them was the person who's referred to in the pleadings and in the sentencing transcript as victim C. Both of them had access to that computer. And so victim B, whether there had been child molestation charges or not, would have been an essential witness, both to prove the defendant's knowledge that the computer contained child pornography and to rebut any defenses by the defendant, either that someone else had put the child pornography on the computer, that it was somehow an accident or a mistake.
But that wasn't the case. I mean, you knew before you went to trial that he had admitted.
Well, we certainly, at the time, the case did not go to trial. There was a blind guilty plea.
I'm sorry. I mean, before the case went to judgment.
We certainly did have what I would consider good evidence coming out of the search warrant that linked the defendant to the child pornography. But as we argued to the district court and as the district court acknowledged, the defendant can still obstruct the investigation in a way to deprive the government of significant additional evidence, which the defendant did in this case, or at least attempted to do. And the fact that we had some evidence that we thought was good evidence doesn't mean that there wasn't a whole universe of additional evidence that could have formed the basis of additional charges against the defendant, that certainly would have been of assistance to the government in meeting its burden to prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, and the enhancement applies even if the defendant merely attempts to obstruct the investigation. He doesn't actually have to succeed in doing so.
Correct. We agree. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Cook?
Don't have much time, but just to comment on Judge Rovner's point, this is our legal argument with respect to the obstruction. We think that, you know, Judge Rovner is absolutely right here. The government had his admission. They had his computer. And the analysis, this is a specific intent provision. They have to show that Mr. Nurek either attempted to or intended to obstruct the count of conviction.
There is no other plausible interpretation of what he did.
Well, his actions went to the victim.
He contacted a child victim and his family repeatedly. He offered to marry his mother. He gave them thousands of dollars. He sent letters and said, keep it between just the two of us. The agents are watching me. There is no other plausible interpretation for what he did.
But those actions go to the enticing charge, not to the receiving
child. They also go to the pornography charge. He was a witness on the whole thing. And it was at a time when he was under indictment for all charges, not just the pornography charge. He attempted to obstruct the investigation beyond any reasonable doubt.
I think if you look at the obstructive conduct, none of it had to do with an image on a computer. I think what's
That's
happening...
That's irrelevant. This child was a witness on all charges, including the pornography charge to which he pled guilty. This is a very sophisticated defendant who has faced child molestation charges in the past, won an acquittal, and continued his behavior.
But the point is that if he obstructed anything, it was the enticement charge.
He knows how to manipulate witnesses. He has successfully done it in the past. The district court judge knew that when he imposed this sentence and applied the enhancement. I find this argument frivolous.
Well, we would just ask the court not to make bad law and bad facts.
It has nothing to do with the legal interpretation of the guideline. This conduct meets it under any interpretation of this guideline.
Well, I'll respectfully disagree. My time is up. Thank you.
Okay. I was just going to add, you see, Mr. Cook, because victim B saw Dr. Newrick viewing the pornography on the computer, that would make victim B's testimony relevant to the offense of conviction and the efforts to influence that testimony really would constitute obstruction. But I do understand your argument that the communications with the victim and his family did not obstructing the particular offense of conviction, which was the receipt of child pornography, not the charge regarding transporting a minor for illicit purposes. So it's very problematic.
Can I just note that,
of course,
if you look at the record in the district court's findings, there was no finding that his obstruction had anything to do with the receipt of child pornography, which goes to our procedural aspect of the argument, that the findings were insufficient in and of themselves. So, are there any more questions?
Very much. The case is taken under advisement.